It was the year of deep geeking.
The year of Feedbackapalooza.
The year we discussed our favorite show.
It was the year without Zima.
The year of great tequila.
The year of puns.
And a year of more interviews.
It was a new chance for fun.
It was the end of the series.
It was the year we made it to Crusade.
The year is 2009. The show, Babylon Podcast.
And welcome back to another Babylon Podcast. I am Summer Brooks.
I am Tim Callender.
And we have no Jeffrey.
He's off, being Hollywood producer guy or something.
And I hope he doesn't forget us when he becomes, rubbing elbows with, Joel Silver and the rest of those guys.
That's right. Walking the red carpet at the premiere of Carology.
Mm-hmm. We'll have there'll be this famous shot in Hollywood Reporter. You've got Bruckheimer and Silver and Willers together sipping on, champagne or no expensive tequila. What's the most expensive tequila in the world, Mike?
Gosh, there's lots of them, but that awesome Rosso's right up there.
Okay, so he'll have a glass of that with the biggest Cheshire Cat grin on his face ever.
We can only hope so.
And us little people will have to stand in line, and Jeffrey, over here, remember me.
On the other hand, if we play our cards right, we could just, Mr. Willarth, if you don't want anyone to hear these recordings of your voice again, you will send $1,000 unmarked bills every week to the following address.
You do realize that it's impossible to blackmail anyone in Hollywood anymore. There's absolutely nothing they haven't done or considered doing.
You're probably right about that.
It just doesn't work anymore.
Mr. Willarth, I understand you've lived a good, clean life. If you don't want anyone to know about this in Hollywood, you will give us $10,000 in unmarked bills. Maybe that's what it's got to come down to.
Well, don't want us to reveal your secret identity as a choir boy.
I actually have the answer to that question. I just looked it up. The ultra premium tequila lay at $225,000 a bottle.
Get out.
Not kidding.
Holy cow.
Yeah, even the Guinness Book of World Record on that one.
So. Now let me guess, it tastes just like Zima.
For $225,000 a bottle, it better not.
Okay, it tastes like really good Zima.
No, at that price, it better be better than sex, okay? Holy cow.
Well, that's my point. My guess is that it costs so much that however it tastes is not going to be equal to whatever you're paying a bottle for it. So you might as well be drinking Zima.
Okay, then.
Gah. Well, I got nothing for the opening.
I happened to do a little research.
Oh, yeah?
I did.
Oh, good. Goody, goody.
Yes. Comes in handy having this Babylon 5 chronologies. Guess what happened in July of 2263? Mm-hmm.
Well, it would have been like my sister's 237th birthday or something.
Quoting here, at a secret meeting, Michael Garibaldi discusses the project to reverse engineer Minbari and Vorlon technology with President Sheridan. The aim is to adapt it to work with Earth Tech, aiding construction on a new destroyer-class White Star, the joint Earth-Minbari venture suggested by President Sheridan in the previous year.
Ooh.
Yes.
Wonder if that ends up being the Valen-class cruiser that we saw in Lost Tales.
It very well. I believe it's actually the precursor to what ended up being the Excalibur. Because it...
Oh, yeah.
It mentions engineer Samuel Drake.
Okay, there you go. Yeah, dates would be about right.
Yes.
Good point. What else you got?
That's it. That's all I looked up. But I did some extra research, some extra digging through my collection in honor of today's Deep Geeking episode, which actually a lot of people for some reason don't like this episode, but I think it's my favorite episode of season 5. I really do.
Oh, I can't wait to discuss this because I have issues.
You have issues with Day of the Dead, really?
I have issues. Should we take a break and go into that?
Yes, yes, I shall have
there
to
go
put on my my Kevlar and get myself a good fight here.
I'm Tim. I'm a carologist.
And I'm Michael, and I'm a carologist.
And I'm Jeffrey, and we are carologists.
Yes.
And you are too. Okay, let's get right to it.
Toyota hybrid.
Toyota.
The Toyota Camry hybrid. And
yeah,
loved that car.
That was wonderful.
So freaking smart. It was smarter than me.
You take it off road?
About once a year, I play in the sand with it.
Because it just seems that so many people have vehicles that have four-wheel drive and never use it. Don't even know how to turn it on or why. I really feel like Mazda has always kind of had their finger on the pulse, and yet they don't flaunt that.
Add your voice to the conversation at www.carology.tv.
Digging down into the most obscure facts and fandom, this is
Deep Geeking Away. Here we are.
Here we go. Are you ready?
I am ready.
Day of the Dead by Neil Gaiman.
Today's episode is, like I said before, I believe it's one of my favorites of season 5. It is written by Neil Gaiman, an author extraordinaire. And I
know by this one.
Is this the first non-JMS script we've had in like 2 years?
Yes. Well, yes, because you can't really count View from the Gallery because that had a byline of both Straczynski and Ellison, as I recall.
Mm-hmm. So this is officially the first non-JMS script since, what, middle of season?
Early season two. Yeah.
So the streak was broken by probably one of the most revered fantasy writers out there.
But you wouldn't know it from watching this one, I don't think.
Hey!
I think this is an example of the sum of the parts being less than the whole being the less than the sum of the parts or something like this. To be charitable, I think it's a case where a writer can be as great as he is, but coming into somebody else's universe, it doesn't necessarily work.
Really?
Yes.
I seem to remember reading somewhere that when JMS read the script, he was jealous. He said, "Oh man, you did what? Holy crap."
Here's the thing, Summer. I've watched it a few times here leading into this, and there are parts in it that I really like. But overall, I just come away going, ugh, there were missed opportunities, and it just, one of the most blatant examples of stunt casting that I've ever seen. And in the end, I just sit there going, if I didn't know how good Sandman was, I wouldn't have thought anything of Neil Gaiman after this one.
Well,
so, do you want to get into specifics?
start at the beginning and tell me more.
Okay. God, it's hard to untangle it. I because again, there's elements of that I really like, but when I look at it as a whole, I really dislike it. I do like most of the characters who meet dead relations. Okay, that was kind of intriguing. But the idea that part of the station actually blips away 200 light years to actually be part of the Brakiri homeworld, for a show that prides itself on trying to maintain a certain level of scientific accuracy, this was really just kind of a major misstep.
Okay. You haven't read a whole lot about quantum mechanics, have you?
I have, but other than the Brakiri being on the station, what sort of quantum entanglement is going on that would slice a mile section out of the station and move it away?
It wasn't physically gone.
Well, yes and no.
No, it said they can't reach it. It didn't say it was physically removed from the station. If it had physically removed from the station, there would have been a hull breach that would have sucked everyone out into space and killed everybody.
Okay, right. Yes, I would agree with you there. But the point was that when they finally get through, when Sheridan finally gets through to Lockley, it's as though they've had to communicate over 200 light years of space or whatever it was.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? I don't know, because it gets back to that whole mystical thing that I had problems with the dreaming in An Atonement. So maybe you could just it up to that.
Let me get this straight. You personally have issues with the fact that a section of Babylon 5 was in some way manipulated to be part of the Brakiri homeworld so it could partake in this festival, but you're okay with tachyons causing a rift in time? Dude.
Well, if Enthel Zah says it, I believe it. Yes, I know. It is selective. It is selective. I'll agree. But see, the tachyons causing the rift in time and space at least has a certain amount of Trekno-babble that I can swallow.
Oh, you wanted Trek level believability. So when something that, you know, goes beyond the grade school science of Star Trek comes along, you have
there is never at any point any indication of greater science going on. All it simply was the Brakiri go in, they buy part of Babylon 5, we'll give it back to you tomorrow, and then this thing happens. They draw a chalk line down the deck.
That's true.
Okay? It wasn't like if they had said, we're setting up the mystical skulls that when their eyes meet, they will do blah, blah, blah. Then I can sit there and I'll go, oh, yeah, okay, I get it. The skulls, even though they're religious objects, are actually quantum teleportation entanglement devices and blah, 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 blah. I get it. That's not what we got. We got a chalk line down the wall.
Okay, so you're upset that no technical explanation was given.
Yes.
All right. What about just believing in the concept of mysticism and magic? The power of belief of 30 billion Brakiri. Thought manifesting.
Yeah, okay, maybe. But again, let's use JMS's own. Hold on. No, let's use JMS's own dictum. If you shoot the gun in Act 3, you got to show it in Act 1, right?
Okay. The fact that there was no gun is what bugs you.
Right.
Okay. All right. I can grok that.
That's yeah, no okay. Problem. Okay. Good. Well, thank you for helping make that a little more plain.
The fact that there was no technical explanation even proffered is what bugs you. It just kind of happened, and you don't know why.
Right.
Okay.
Right. Okay. Okay.
I can. All right. I'll give you a pass on that.
Okay. That is one. That's one of my issues.
Okay.
The next issue, and this is separate from Day of the Dead, but do we want to leave the deal with this in terms of mounting frustration with the episode, or just we'll just go into it. Here is my biggest problem with the episode is Lanier and Morden.
And
I'll tell you why. There's two things in going on. Number one is, okay, just between the two of them, nothing happens. Okay, Morden shows up at Lanier's quarters. He waves his fighting pike in Morden's nose, and then they don't talk to each other until 5 seconds left to go. By the way, you're going to betray Sheridan. See you later. What? Beyond that, all the other characters who met their dead friends or whatever had some sort of relationship with those persons. Okay. And this is one of those things. I liked the bit with Lockley and Zoe. You got a better sense of who Lockley is. I think that's one of the best acting performances that Tracy Scoggins got to do on the show in that 1 year. You know, I could really feel the angst that she had at seeing Zoe again. Londo and Adira was marvelous. Dodger and Garibaldi was a ton of fun. And again, they can't make that connection, you know, because there's Lise in there. It's like the invisible triangle going on. That's fun. Lanier and Morden had nothing to do with each other in the entire show. So there's no connection there to really give weight to the big prophecy that Morden drops in Lanier's lap.
Okay.
Okay? So that whole encounter becomes pointless. And if you're looking for a way to get for Lanier to hear this new prophecy or whatever, you know, it could be just as simple as stuff that Straczynski had done throughout the show. Lanier bumps into a Centauri lady who happens to be one of those seers, and she gets the freaky, clairvoyant thing going on.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a passing thing in the customs area. But then, you know, when Lanier does leave Sheridan out to dry, as it were, you sit there going, oh my God, 10 episodes ago, that was the law. And we sit there praising the genius of J. Michael Straczynski. Plus, it seemed just really grafted on. You know, if it was Neil Gaiman's story, that part of it just really seemed like JMS going, oh, by the way, I need you to write this in.
Okay. I will give you the fact that, you know, I'll give you that the Morden Lanier bit was not as impactful as the others on any level, except for one small thing. I believe it was the use of Morden as an unreliable narrator, because he was affiliated with the Shadows. Lanier has no reason to believe a word he says. Like you said, there was no relationship there. So I think he was meant to be give us the appearance of a red herring.
But you're bringing Morden back. I mean, I don't know.
Who else would he have visited?
Veer.
Huh?
Veer.
Veer wasn't there.
I know, but if you're going to bring Morden back, Veer is the logical counterpoint to Morden.
Yeah. I would think Veer. Londo was already occupied. Maybe Jakar.
No, not even. It's Veer or nobody.
And what would he have to say to Veer?
I don't know. I don't have a response to that, because the whole point of it gets back to what you're saying. Morden is supposed to be this unreliable narrator. His only function in the story is to give that little bit of prophecy that Lanier is going to do something that will harm the Alliance.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
And
in the end, that's really that it's pointless because the whole thing is without that, still, Lanier's arc throughout season five is a powerful one as it is. Okay? His progression from the character who's trying to prove something desperately to the woman he loves, he's carrying a torch for, to the point where he is willing to take action or inaction because he's so wrapped up in that emotion. It doesn't need Morden to show up and say, you're going to do something stupid.
But see, I disagree, because at the very end of that, you get a hint, and that this is a credit to, you know, Bill's acting. You get that hint of denial and desperation in his retort. Only by the time when he turns around, he's not there. You get the hint that what Morden said could become true, and that's the first time you actually feel the desperation and the desolation in Lanier. And that's when you realize, okay, we now know that he's internally unstable and really doing all this for the wrong reasons.
I disagree. I think it's apparent going on. I mean, Delenn even tells John at one point, you know, Lanier's going to join the Rangers for the wrong reason. You know, I think it's apparent. It's been apparent for a couple of years that Lanier's on a bad way down.
It's been apparent to everybody except Lemire himself. Nobody has actually stepped up and told him that he listened to, that, dude, this is the wrong move. And having it come from somebody who he has no real connection to, I mean, he actually heard Morden say it, where he actually didn't hear it when Delenn told him.
Yeah, well, he's not going to hear it from Delenn because he just doesn't want to, you know, that's that whole deniability thing. But what if Veer at some other point had said that to him? I mean, there's a relationship there, and you never get a sense of how close they were or weren't. You know, part of what you got was more that they were acquaintances because of their position, their relative positions.
But Veer had no knowledge or understanding of what Lanier was going through. Literally, now I will give you this. The one person who should have come back and told Lanier that this was all the wrong thing to do should have been Marcus.
Yeah, exactly. Perfect. Much better. Much better. Because then you got Marcus. He can sit there going, don't make the same mistakes I did.
Right. Marcus was the one who Lemire told that he had, you know, he loved Delenn. And, he, you know, Marcus knew. He's like, oh, I don't love her that way. Marcus is like, yeah, right. Come on. So Marcus has knowledge of Lemire's longing. He knows about joining the On the Shock for the wrong reasons. It would have been better. And mm-hmm. we probably could have had more of a conversation between the two of them if it had been Marcus.
Yes, exactly.
Right. And exactly. But, you know, that would have, I see the dilemma, because that would have eradicated any chance at all, or any doubt at all whether or not Marcus was in suspended animation or truly dead.
I don't know, not necessarily.
Well, you know, everybody likes that there's a still a question mark. Having him show up during Day of the Dead would have erased that question mark. How that would affect things later,
no,
I don't know.
Because, you know, I mean, if we're getting to the get back to the mystical mumbo jumbo that I hate, but is obviously in the episode, while everybody else says, yeah, I'm dead. Adira says, yeah, I'm dead. Dodger says, oh, yeah, the reports of my death were not even exaggerated a little bit. And Zoe says, yeah, I remember being dead. To have Marcus go, well, you know what? I'm not really sure. I mean, that would have been potent. You know, and that would have been a nice counterpoint to everything else that's going on.
Yeah. So, yeah, I will give you that the emotional connection that the other encounters had didn't resonate
in there, but I don't hate it as much as you do. I like even when I first saw it, I'm like, now why wasn't that Marcus? Because he's a ranger and he knows about unrequited love. Duh.
Yeah, and as far as it goes, even it's a lost opportunity to have Ed Wasser chew the scenery. He's just sat there reading the newspaper. I mean, if you're going to have Morn, at least let him be the slimy, nasty used car salesman smile going on. Give him some meat.
Mm.
And that's why I think that was one of those that just got, oh, I want this in here. Shove it in here. I mean, I don't know. We, you know, the only way to know would be ask JMS, and we didn't, so.
It'd be nice to find out if it was just a matter of who was available. Like, Ed was available and Jason wasn't.
Sure. That very well could be, because, you know, because I was thinking about that watching it again tonight when Adira showed up. It's like, you know, we saw her last 5 years ago. And, you know, part of me is like going, wow, what a great stroke of luck to have the actress available. And then I'm also thinking, from what we've learned from all our other conversations with actors on the show, it's like, poor thing probably hadn't worked in a while. I was very grateful to get the call.
Interesting.
So there's that. See, one of the things that I did like, I liked Jakar's little bit in the episode, because one of the things that I thought was nice that ran counter to such things, he was the voice of doom, the one saying, Captain Lockley, don't do this. This is a bad idea. Don't do it. But when all is said and done, he's the one that's going, you know?
I wish I'd stayed.
Right, exactly. And I liked that. I thought that was a nice twist.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't like that he shows up to sleep in CNC, though.
I like that he... I don't like how they portrayed him as being against it. He as someone who is very, very spiritual. He never expounded on what he thought was dangerous about it.
Right.
You know, but his turnabout of saying, you know, okay, something mystical happened, we may never know what, but everybody seems to have had a moment of closure for themselves. And that in itself would have been worth the risk.
Right, right. But I agree with you. It's Shakar's motivation is completely arbitrary. Although it gives us the nice little interchange between he and Lockley. You know, the Declaration of Principles, you might have heard of it. I wrote it. But that, to me, that's an exemplar of this episode. There are these great little moments, but they're arbitrary. They don't really parse logically with what we know of the characters and how the universe has been set up.
Maybe.
Okay.
Maybe. So maybe. What What did you like about the other interactions?
Well, I did like that, again, Lockley, we really understand more about her character without it being just dry, expository biography. Or even somebody digging around and confronting, I found out you were a drug addict and blah, blah, blah. You get the emotional component of it.
Right.
You know, she sees this girl that she was slumming with and didn't know it any better. And the scene, it was so moving where Zoe says to her, but we had a good time, right? And Lockley just goes, we were cold, we were sick, we were hungry all the time.
Uh-huh.
You know, and basically, you know, Lockley 20, 30 years ago probably would have told Zoe, yeah, we're having a great time. But now she's come so far. She's gotten her act together, but never forgets where she came from. But she's got the clarity to say, no, that wasn't a good time.
She's got the clarity of having survived it and overcome it.
Right.
Zoe was still, it's like she remembers being high as having fun, and that's all she was hooked into at that moment in time.
She's also, you know, being high to avoid the terror of the situation.
Right.
You know, that's the flip side of it. She doesn't want to admit that it was this horrible situation, and she's just looking for the next hit. I mean, that's what, you know, she even tells Lockley, you got any stuff?
Mm-hmm.
She's a dead girl. You know? But the other part that I liked is that it gives that softer side of Lockley without being gooey and sentimental. You know, the whole time she's just been painted as this real hard-nosed soldier here to straighten everything out. And as soon as she sees Zoe, she just about breaks down. And it was wonderful.
Yeah, we get a background of how she joined the military. We get her background before she was in the military. She was trying to escape the life her father had.
Yeah.
And he was the one who came to her rescue, and she ended up joining the military to straighten, you know, herself out.
Right.
And we also get the story of what her life was like before then. And we know later when she confronts Garibaldi, you know, she said, yeah, I had a problem too. We don't need to hear the story then when she's trying to, you know, get Garibaldi to realize what he's doing. We already know.
Exactly. I love Dodger and Garibaldi. It's that same awkward situation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, well, you know, she's ready to toss him in the sack, and well, Lisa's come back around again, and the timing is just awful.
Yep.
You know, and Garibaldi's response was great. It was perfect Garibaldi. You know, he hears the shower going. The first thing he does is pull the PPG from under his pillow. You know, what are you? You're one of Bester's tricks. Yeah, I mean, he goes right there, you know, looking for the explanation.
Our favorite paranoid.
Right. And Dodger's departure back to the land of the dead or whatever it was, that was moving too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, she's come back to Garibaldi for whatever reason. There's a connection there that brought her back, and I like that. The whole bit with, you know, singing Emily Dickinson to Yellow Rose of Texas, that was funny. But then when she says, it's time for me to go, you know, it's like, wow, it's just really sad.
Yep. And just some of the lines, her entire mannerism during that was just funny. Especially the one where she jumps up and, you know, salutes, you know, Private First Class, Emily, not just that, deceased.
Yeah, right.
And then that whole conversation where Lockley is giving Garibaldi an order and Zoe's head's peeking up over his shoulder trying to see what's going on. And you've got Dodger in the background standing at attention because, hey, she's dead, but she's still a Marine. She's going to, you know, stand at attention in front of a superior officer.
Yeah. Loved it. That's good stuff. It makes me, you know, as we're talking about it, it makes me wonder whether or not that's the stuff that Gaiman wrote that was the really good stuff. And then the other, got to say, the ham-handed stuff was that JMS or what? Because the other part of it that really bothers me is the whole Rebo and Zooty stuff. And believe me, I find Penn and Teller very funny. I think they're brilliant, but this really struck me as two big fans of the show going, hey, can we show up and just be part of the crowd? And somebody goes, hey, why don't we make them Rebo and Zooty?
I thought them being Rebo and Zooty was a perfect casting. What I didn't think was perfect was the discussion they had with, you know, John and Delenn about leaving comedy and going into politics.
Yes.
That seemed like it was, you know, shoehorned in there a little tough.
No, don't you understand? Making people laugh is just as patriotic as running for office. Boy, bae. He's right, but it's like,
I don't know. It's just that one scene. Everything else they did was funny because you see them make Delenn laugh and she finally gets the humor, and then the part at the end where Londo is cracking up. They because we've seen in the past where Londo just didn't get it, and now that he's met them and they tell more jokes, he's like, oh, I get it now, but you know, you have to do this. And those parts were fine. It was just that one scene where the, I don't know, false maudlinism, I don't, it didn't fit in the entire episode.
Right, right.
And I can't put my finger on what about it's wrong.
Because it in the same way as Morden's little prophecy to Lanier, it's just this thing that's dropped in there because for no other reason than somebody wanted to have it said.
Well, the thing is like that part rang, the Morden Lanier thing never rang false to me. That one scene with Penn and Teller, you know, with Rebo and Zudi and Sheridan and Dolan, that just, it stuck out like 40 sore thumbs. The Morden and Lanier thing was just, you know, a slippery spot.
For me, that's 39 thumbs. I have to say, I thoroughly understood Captain Lockley's reaction to the duo when they come on board.
I get it for different reasons, but I want to hear your reasons.
I just didn't find them funny. Because to me, Penn and Teller's humor tends toward the ironic and frankly satirical. Okay? And a touch mean-spirited sometimes. Okay, and that's part of the, you know, they kind of have that outrage. With Rebo and Zudi, they were just kind of being Laurel and Hardy.
Okay.
And there's nothing wrong with that, but I just didn't think that the kind of humor that they were trying to get across was particularly funny.
Okay, so who as a working pair of comedians would you thought of would have fit better? I'm guessing
nobody. I wouldn't have even put them in there.
Really?
Yes, that's why I'm thinking this was Penn Jillette called up and said, you know what? We saw you had Doug Adams on. We're big fans. Could we just be in the crowd in a Zocalo somewhere? And somebody said, hey, let's make them Rebo and Zudi.
Hmm.
I know that we get A and B stories quite often in Babylon 5. I'm not saying that there should not have been a B story. Okay? But something else.
I don't think that they would have just called up and say, hey, can we be on the show too? I think that came about a different way, but I'm going to have to. That's
I wish
it.
Jeffrey was here.
I'll have my minions research.
I know, and somebody will tell me that I'm full of it, and that's fine too. I'm thoroughly used to it at this after 4.5 years of doing this. But nevertheless, I'll stand by it that I really, you know, however it came about, it was less because we have a story here that makes sense to get these guys involved, and it was more like we know they're fans, they want to be on the show. What can we do to get them on?
Okay. And the thing is, like,
here's a better example. June Lockhart, when she was cast, okay, you could have called that stunt casting, but the point of the fact was that she was good for the role. They had a role, and she fit it. Walter Koenig is Bester. You know, the first response when you first heard that he was going on the show, it's like, yeah, that's kind of stunt casting, but you know what? There was the role, and he needed it, you know, and needed someone, and he was perfect for it. This is one of those cases where I don't think they had the roles. I think they had the actors first.
Okay. I'm being told in the chat room that you're wrong because they added the machine thing in so that Teller wouldn't have to talk. So that was an afterthought, having the machine do the talking. So they were not the first choice for casting.
I think that's circumstantial. I think that's what that is.
We'll figure it out. But yeah. During the reception where everybody's laughing at their jokes and Lockley's rolling her eyes.
Yes.
I know that look. That's the look that I get when the guys who I used to hang out with in college would start just quoting everything or imitating everything Three Stooges.
See, I love the Three Stooges.
It's one of the, literally, I honestly think Three Stooges is something that only men get, and women just look at it and go, okay.
Yeah, it's generally a gender thing. I'll agree with you completely.
I don't get it. I grew up a tomboy, and even I don't get the Three Stooges. I can't explain it. So seeing that one scene, the first time I saw it, where she had that look on her face, I lost it because I know that look.
And I liked it. That was also good Lockley too. You know, she's just, it's not that she doesn't have a sense of humor. It's just that, ugh, this is ridiculous.
Yeah, and it paralleled so well with the scene of her in her quarters where, like, every channel.
Yeah.
And she's like, oh, come on, kill me already. Give me something else.
Yeah, yeah. And I know her frustration where it's like you want to have the noise on of the TV or the entertainment or whatever, and it's like there's nothing on, but you don't really want silence. I mean, I get that conundrum too. I like that. I also liked, you know, the other thing that I liked in the episode is I liked what little we saw of Corwin. I like how his character continues to grow, and mm-hmm. we see it grow as this year goes on. You know, the little bit with the hat, that was funny.
Again, it's a guy thing, trying to imitate what you're saying.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah.
That's hilarious. Did we talk enough about Londo and Adira?
We didn't. We hardly touched on it. And I'm not quite sure what to say. I thought it was touching, but again, it's, if nothing else, I think it just only underlines how alone Londo is.
Mm-hmm. I actually watched those segments with those two closer this time around because there was a hint of something, you know, last year or whenever the last time I watched it, and I wanted to watch for it this time, and I honestly did see it. She is sad for him because she knows what's coming for him, so she takes that moment to, you know, it's almost like giving him one last moment of joy and comfort.
There's
a profound sadness where in this one scene where she's like touching his face, and it's like her heart is breaking because she knows what he has to go through still. And I thought that was well done because everybody else sort of gave a hint of something and she didn't. Like Morden gave a hint of the future. Dodger kind of, not really so much, but just of,
no, everybody, I hear you. Everybody gave a gift to somebody of some kind.
More like, you know, how to be more in the moment, you know, for that instead of worrying about everything. And for Adira, it was just, you know, giving him a moment to be who he really wanted to be instead of what everyone else expected him to be. And the sadness in her, you know, even though she was happy to see him, happy to be with him, and happy that her appearance made him happy, there was still a profound sadness underlying that. And that was just, and when I saw it this time, I was like, whoa.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And one of the things that you also get with Londo is that he knows, I mean, he may not know the shape of it, but he knows his life as he knows it is over. You know, he will become the man who has everything and nothing.
Right. But he doesn't yet know that he's going to be a prisoner. He just thinks he's going to be a captive to the role of emperor. He doesn't know yet it's going to be worse than that.
Right. Correct.
But she does.
Yeah.
That's my story.
Yeah, I mean, when he tells her, I'm going to be emperor. It's like he can't hardly believe it, but he also knows that it's like, You know, I'd even give up that to have you back. That was, I mean, that's kind of the underlying tone there.
And the counterpoint of that is the start of it, where he's sitting there talking to the picture of the first emperor. Yes. Okay, talk to me. Come on, where are you? Hey, you listening?
Yeah.
Knew this was crap, and then she's there.
Yeah. Yeah, I did like that. That was perfect, Londo.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, Summer, I will say that you have given me different ways of thinking about this, but I still maintain this is one of my least favorite Year 5 episodes.
Well, look at it this way. Like I said, this is one of my favorites, and as a collectible, one of the things that I have is the annotated Day of the Dead script.
Oh.
Which came out from, where is it? There's a bookstore in Minnesota, Dreamhaven Books. For a while, they had copies. They were the only place you could get signed copies of this script. So I have one. Well, I should back up. I have two of these. I had one, and it was signed inside by Neil Gaiman. You know, he signed it.
Wow.
Yeah, he would put like Zoot or Zoot Zoot in them along with his name. And during one of my moves, actually it was when I moved from New Jersey to Arizona, I misplaced it. I thought I lost it. I was upset. I was angry. I was distraught. I was vengeful. Luckily, I found out that Dreamhaven Books still had a few copies, so I ordered another one. It was like $20. And then when I moved from my first Arizona apartment to my next Arizona apartment, guess what turned up? My first guy. So I have two of these that are signed by Neil Gaiman. One of them signed in like a brownish purple, and the other one signed in red. So, but the script is... I don't know if this was a shooting script or just one that was cleaned up. Here it is. I'm looking for this sentence. There's an introduction that JMS wrote, and where he said, I have allowed myself the conceit that he did it because he genuinely loves the show and the characters rather than simply to get me to stop sleeping on his front lawn every night. The former is what he told me, and as an act of faith, I have come to believe it. What follows is what followed. The episode was a hit not only with the fans, but the cast and crew, who were charmed by him while he was on set. Of all of the freelance scripts that came into B5, this was the most effortless, the most fun, the most insightful. When Captain Lockley recites her password, and we learn that the key phrase is Zoe's dead, we learn more about her character in that two-second phrase than in the multiple hour-long episodes that preceded it. Close-up magic. It bugs the hell out of me. Enjoy.
Yeah. All right, so you could probably go through that script that's annotated and refute everything I've said.
I probably could. I will let our listeners do that, because I know for a fact that five people in the chat room called in to call shenanigans on you while you were talking.
Fair enough. That's good. Good.
Anyway, I think
still stand by it.
Okay, you can stand by it.
for this week anyway.
We're going to knock some of that sand out from underneath your pedestal there. So that'll be it for our Day of the Dead chatting for this week. But I'm sure we're going to have an entire episode's worth of voicemail to continue the discussion. But that will be for another day. Is the long drive to work getting you down? Do you feel like the other drivers want to run you off the road and beat you with the tire iron of life? Relax. Take a break. And let the fun of sci-fi news geeking ease your drive time woes. Slice of Sci-Fi.
It's not as good as having a stormtrooper on your hood, but it's close.
SliceOfSciFi.com.
And we're back. Taking a breather, taking a swig to refresh our palates.
Mm-hmm. You shouldn't talk so much, Summer. It's bad for your voice. Hey, the TikTok man tells us that we have a limited amount of time left, so I'm going to read an email. We got a couple voicemails, so here you go. You ready? This comes to us from Mo Cruz. She writes, I am slowly catching up. I am now up to number 129. Being unemployed has some benefits, not many but a few. But I just had to ask, what happened to Yarsto? Haven't heard his messages for a long time. Well, Mo, just so happens that when you put out vibes into the underspace, strange things occur.
Really?
Yeah. Mike?
This is Yarsto from the Netherlands, responding to episode 164. Yes, it's once again time for me to remind you that I am still out here, and to chime in for a few corrections.
Yay!
First of all, the whole season 5 would have ended on Rising Star tangent. Under most circumstances, this might just have been forgivably wrong. But only a couple of weeks after you had JMS on the show, it's shocking. He actually confirmed in the interview that he'd always envisioned Babylon 5 in the structure of a novel, including the denouement at the end. To reiterate the whole structure, we have 1. Introduction, 2. Rising tensions, 3. Complications, 4. Climax, and 5. Denouement. Rising Star is clearly the end of the climax, so there would always have been something after Rising Star. The plan for a 5-season arc was never going to end on a happy high with the start of the Alliance. To quote the great maker, from the interview no less, it's all about the consequences. And because Mike is starting to worry about time right now, I'll split this voicemail in two. You know, Gary style.
Okay, I think we have to clear something up because it might not have been completely clear from our Babble that episode. We know that Intersections in Real Time initially was going to be the end of the 4th season. We know this.
No, but I think what Yarsto is responding to, and some other people have as well, was that my contention at one point was that I thought Rising Star would have been the end of the entire series, or the penultimate episode, with the final episode being Sleeping in Light.
Right. The thing that they were missing is we were talking about other could have beens in what we got. Like, how would you rearrange the pieces of the puzzle to end here, begin here? I'm pretty sure, at least that's what I had in my head when we were talking about this. I was like, well, no, we could have ended here, we could have ended here, and then, you know, had a different end of season 5 or different middle of season 5. This would have gone here. We were talking about could have beens.
Yeah. No. And no. I mean, I'll be honest. I did harbor that the thought that Rising Star would have been that penultimate episode. And yes, I did notice JMS mentioned something about it in the interview. And if I clung to my original preconception post interview, then that is my mistake, and I freely admit to it. Because having reflected upon it, I realized that I was in error.
Well, you also had 15 years to hold on to that preconception.
Yeah, there is that. Okay, let's hear the next voicemail from Gary. Yarsto.
This is Yarsto from the Netherlands, once again responding to episode 164. And here's the second point I wanted to chime in on, the long-running debate about View from the Gallery and Bo and Mac. I like Gary's suggestion of a diary integrated into the ISN documentary, but I've always seen this episode as essentially allegorical. Possibly conflating the adventures of a real-life Bo and Mac from several crises into one easy story, or maybe even casting Bo and Mac as our everyman characters, representing the entire station maintenance crew during a crisis. In an allegorical scenario, ending up in the middle of and even taking an active part in a firefight doesn't seem too far-fetched. Surely some of the maintenance crew must have ended up in that situation during one of the many battles around Babylon 5. Anyway, that's my contribution for now. And remember, I will be listening.
Okay, there we have it from on high. A View from the Gallery is Babylon 5's version of the Dime Store Western.
Sure, if you want to believe that.
I'm just, just throwing it out there as an allegorical tale that kind of, told from the unreliable witness who was there, you got the old guy who says, yes, I was at the, such and such a battle. No, you were 4 years old during that.
Yeah, right.
That actually puts a slightly different spin on it. I don't.
I guess it doesn't change my opinion of the episode.
It's just a fun different way to think about it.
Yeah. Okay.
Just think about it. There's no real stores where you can buy those dime novels anymore. And do they have westerns in space other than Firefly?
No, because there's no real direction in that sense in space. There's no east or west or north or south.
Ooh, you went there.
It's space, man.
It's space. Okay, fine. I do have one addition from Gary about Day of the Dead, or about the relationship between Garibaldi and Dodger. According to Gary, it was confirmed by Jerry Doyle that prior to the existence of B5, he and Marie Marshall had actually dated.
Really?
So when she showed up on scene for Gropo, it was kind of one of those, hey, wait.
Yeah, my current wife is on the next soundstage over.
So I thought that, well, I had no idea about that. I'm going to have to get a little bit more detail on that. And again, I wish Jeffrey was here so I could ask.
He did it on purpose. He knew we'd have questions, and he's just making us squirm a little bit.
Possibly. And we even have a line from Caution there, so he did do this. He did. But other than that, is that it for the voicemails from yours, though?
That's it.
In that case, it is time to say farewell until next week. If you want to submit your own voicemails, even if they're messages asking Yarsto to keep contributing more, you can send an email to babylonpodcast@gmail.com. Join in the conversations here at the website, babylonpodcast.com, or over at the forums, farpointforums.com. Look for the Babylon Podcast thread. Or call in your own voicemails in between Gary and Neil and everybody else. That number is 206-338-2259. That's 206-338-2259.
The year of the comet brought great blessings upon us all, and once again the dead walked the station.
And we'll see you next time on the other side of the hyperspace rift and down of the station.
That they never explained.